Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
Hey, it's Latif from Radiolab. Our goal with each episode is to make you think, how did I live this long and not know that? Radiolab. Adventures on the edge of what we think we know. Listen wherever you get podcasts.
Good morning. You're listening to The Brian Lehr Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, City Hall and politics reporter for the WNYC Newsroom, filling in for Brian today. On today's show, we'll explain the upcoming changes to how we vote in New York elections and unpack some of the proposed changes to the city charter. Also, the science, culture, and history of breast cancer, plus why new rent changes are actually causing a bottleneck for the state agency charged with reviewing tenant complaints. But first, yesterday, in an 8-page letter to the Democratic leaders, the White House said it would not cooperate with the impeachment inquiry of President Donald Trump, escalating tensions between Congress and the executive branch. Signed by a member of the White House counsel, the letter states, "To fulfill his duties to the American people, the Constitution, the executive branch, and all future occupants of the office of the presidency, President Trump and his administration cannot participate in your partisan and unconstitutional inquiry under these circumstances." The New York Times this morning writes that with this letter, the White House is declaring war against the impeachment inquiry. The impeachment inquiry came, of course, after President Trump's phone call to Ukrainian President Vladimir Zelensky. But let's talk about another phone call with a foreign leader, the consequences of which are playing out as we speak, consequences that may include a literal war. On Sunday night, after a phone call between President Trump and the President of Turkey, the United States announced it would withdraw its military support of Syria. This morning, Turkish forces have crossed the border into northeastern Syria to force back the Kurdish militants controlling the border area. Joining me now to discuss how all this happened and what's next is Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post. Ishan, welcome back to WNYC.
Thanks for having me.
So just this morning, a spokesman for the Kurdish fighters has said that Turkish warplanes have started attacking the region. Do you know what the latest is on the ground there?
Well, indeed, the Turkish offensive, as that's been imminent for quite some time, is now underway. The Turkish authorities themselves have already announced it. It appears that not only are they targeting positions along the Syrian border with howitzers, artillery, and warplanes, but also a ground incursion is underway. We don't know how extensive these incursions are going to be. Some Turkish reports said that they would not proceed into Syria beyond a kind of 18-mile corridor. But certainly something serious is happening right now.
So let's back up a little bit. This all began on Sunday after a phone call between President Trump and the president of Turkey, Recep Tayyip Erdogan. Can you tell us what the two of the leaders were talking about?
Well, for a long time, the Turks have not been particularly pleased with the American presence on the other side of the border, specifically because the Americans have been allied with a Syrian Kurdish faction that the Turks really don't like. They view this faction of the Syrian Kurds backed by the United States as equivalent to a terrorist organization operating inside Turkey. So the Turks for a very long time have wanted to reduce their presence, smash their hold on certain parts of northeastern Syria, and this has been a longstanding complaint. Now, President Trump has his own interests as well. He, of course, has, as he has tweeted repeatedly over the last couple of days, is very keen to disentangle the United States from the Middle East and from the conflicts in the Middle East. And he saw that, look, okay, the Turks can come in and take over some of the responsibilities that we have been currently bearing in the sort of stabilization of these parts of Syria that the Islamic State used to hold sway over. The conversation that they had was apparently, according to different versions of it, a little bit testy or very amiable. Various other things on the table were discussed. You have to understand that U.S.-Turkey relations in general right now are not in a great place. But not only was Trump discussing what happens in Syria, but a potential $100 billion trade deal, ways in which The White House can navigate around congressional bans on military sales to Turkey. So there's a lot in play. But the main picture is that Trump wants out and the Turks want in.
So listeners, anyone out there with connections to Syria or the Kurds in that region, we want to hear from you. Give us a call now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692, or tweet us at Brian Lehr. Now, Ishan, you touched on this already, but just so our listeners can really understand, what is it that Turkey has against the Kurds in Syria?
Well, to step back a little bit, we tend as a journalistic shorthand just to say the Kurds as if they are some kind of monolith. But we are talking about an ethnic group that's close to 40 million people scattered across four different countries and divided by all sorts of divisions, political, tribal, even in some cases religious. But for the sake of this conversation, for what's happening right now, the focus is on the SDF. The SDF are the Syrian Democratic Forces. They are the kind of fighting coalition led by Kurdish militias that the United States has depended on in the fight against the Islamic State. But the Turks see the SDF as really an extension of, and forgive me, this is a bit of an alphabet soup, but it's important to understand the alphabet soup. So they see the SDF as an extension of the YPG, which is a Syrian Kurdish faction that, and here's one more acronym, and then I'll stop with the acronyms, is related to the PKK, which is a Kurdish separatist organization operating in Turkey. And the Turks, as well as the Americans, have listed the PKK as a terrorist organization. So essentially what the Turks say to the United States is that, look, you're fighting the Islamic State, but you're fighting the Islamic State with another band of terrorists. Now, there are plenty in the West who disagree with that analysis and who have more sympathy for the Syrian Kurdish factions on the ground than they do for the Turks. They see the Syrian Kurds as both progressive, secular. They have, you know, there's a lot said about the fact that there are women-only fighting units in these ranks. And so they've really kind of, there's a romantic version of this that's really captured the imagination of people in Washington and elsewhere in the West. So there's a huge divide on, and of course there are a lot of feelings in Washington that, you know, for decades we've backed the Turks and we've kind of turned our backs on the Kurds here and there. For decades we've given various Kurdish factions hope that the United States would help their aspirations for national independence or some greater autonomy. And in many cases, the United States has let down various Kurdish factions in the past. And so what we're seeing right now is another kind of intensification of the Kurdish narrative of disappointment and betrayal with the United States.
You touched on this, but when we do talk about the Kurds in the Middle East, it is this reference as a monolith, but you've talked about how they're actually the region's largest stateless ethnic group. Where else are they in the region, and what are some of the issues that are uniting and dividing them?
Well, so there are roughly close to 40 million of them. They are primarily in Turkey, Iran, Iraq, and Syria. The biggest population of Kurds is in Turkey, across the border from what we're looking at right now. That's a heavily Kurdish area in southeastern Turkey. The biggest Kurdish city in the world is still, I think, Istanbul. So they're not totally geographically concentrated. So there are plenty of divisions. The SDF and the YPG, which are the factions that we're talking about in Syria, are pretty secular, and they're based on, they're formed, they came from a kind of Marxist-Leninist place, whereas there are many Kurds in Turkey and elsewhere who are rather religious and don't subscribe to the same ideology as the PKK, YPG, and so on. Across the border in Iraq, you have a whole constellation of Kurdish factions there. You have an autonomous government in northern Iraq that is a de facto kind of autonomous Kurdish state that operates within Iraq. And they have plenty of divisions as well with the SDF on the other side. And they've had lots of disagreements in the past with them, and they don't necessarily see eye to eye or have the same common goals. And then, of course, in Iran, you have other Kurdish factions who have battled the Iranian state, the Iraqis. It's a very big, complex chessboard. But I hope that gives you a bit of a primer.
I've been writing down all of the alphabet soup just to keep up with you. another angle of the story that's emerging is that Syrian Kurdish forces are currently guarding about 20 Islamic prisons. And this morning, the Washington Post reported that Kurdish officials said that guards were prepared to move, raising the possibility that about 11,000 militants and their families could escape. Can you tell us more about these prisons and how they've come to be guarded by Syrian Kurdish forces?
Right. So as you said, as my colleagues have reported, there are about 20 detention camps with Islamic State related fighters or their families scattered across this part of Syria. When the United States pressed its campaign against ISIS in the last couple of years, especially into Syria, its boots on the ground were the SDF, were these Kurdish fighters. So as Islamic State readout after readout fell to the advance, it was left to the SDF to sort of pick up the pieces and try to stable and hold control over these people. They lost close to 10,000, maybe more than 10,000 fighting men in the campaign against the Islamic State. And since then, the burden of coping with what's left of the Islamic State has fallen on them. So the SDF administers these camps with not particularly great resources. The U.S. has been assisting the administration of these camps. But, the biggest one is one called Al-Hol, which is up to 70,000 people, including maybe as many as 10,000 really hardcore fighters still in there. This is a camp that's basically a town in its own right, and the SDF has struggled to keep security over it, and there are fears that in the case of an extensive Turkish incursion that requires SDF to relocate its troops and reinforce areas that are under attack, the Kurds will have to abandon these places or at least weaken the strength guarding these camps, and so we could see breakouts, we could see people released so they can focus their attentions elsewhere, and that's a real concern. The Pentagon yesterday told my colleagues that they don't have at this point a backup plan for what happens in the administration of these camps. They cannot on their own, with the very meager U.S. footprint that is in Syria, administer these camps. Hmm. So it's a real sense of crisis. President Trump, seeing all this or sort of taking all this into consideration, has turned around and said, look, if the Turks are doing this, then it's on the Turks to take care of the situation and neutralize the ISIS threat. Turkish spokespeople have echoed that, saying, don't worry, we'll handle it. It's unclear how any of this is going to really play out. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, President Trump has also made a big fuss about the fact that we have thousands of European nationals who joined the Islamic State, who are in these camps, and who various European countries do not want to take back. So Trump is very eager that the Europeans take them back, and now has said, look, because you guys aren't taking these guys back, they may get out again, and that's your fault. So he's basically casting a wide net of blame elsewhere.
So listeners, comments or questions on the situation in Syria for Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post. Tweet us or give us a call now at 212-433-WNYC. That's 212-433-9692. Let's go to Amir in Queens. Amir, welcome to WNYC. What's your question?
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it. And good morning, everybody. I'm calling today because I find it a little hard, this narrative in which we're talking about Syria without speaking about the Syrian government. Syria is a sovereign state that is being torn apart by Turkey. It's being torn apart by the United States. Syria wouldn't be in this position if the United States hadn't intervened in Syria in the first place. So I think that's really not being spoken about when we talk about Syria. It's a sovereign state, and what role can the Syrian government play in fighting ISIS rather than our quote-unquote allies in Syria?
Ishan, what's your response to that?
Well, indeed, obviously, nothing can really be settled right now without a political resolution to the Syrian conflict, which is ongoing. The Assad regime has done a pretty thorough job in consolidating its hold on a lot of the country at this point, but it's not particularly relevant in northeastern Syria, where the SDF holds sway, and it still is facing a pocket of resistance in Idlib province in northwestern Syria. What we may see in the sort of medium term is that since they feel betrayed by the United States, the SDF and various Syrian Kurdish factions in northeastern Syria will probably find some kind of accord with the Syrian government, and in that sense, at least I don't really want to comment on the sort of historical narrative. It's a complicated story. I don't necessarily agree that ISIS's rise is entirely related to U.S. policy vis-a-vis the Syrian war, but what we could see is a scenario where the Syrian Kurds find greater accommodation with the Assad regime going forward, for sure.
Amir, thanks for calling WNYC. Ishan, 2 days ago, President Trump tweeted that he would, quote, obliterate the economy of Turkey if the country does anything he deems to be, quote, off limits. Trump added, they must, with Europe and others, watch over the captured ISIS fighters and families. So you talked about a little bit of this, but is President Trump expecting Turkey to take over these prisons?
Apparently so, although, you talk to administration officials and they don't necessarily think that's what's going to happen. We'll see how extensive these incursions are. They've just launched their offensive this morning or in the afternoon there. But what vis-a-vis his threats about obliterating Turkey's economy, as I mentioned earlier, U.S.-Turkey relations are not in a great place before any of this. The U.S. has been very angry, especially politicians here in Washington and Congress were very angry with the Turks when they went ahead with the major purchase of a defense air defense military system from the Russians. This is a NATO ally purchasing Russian technology, and that triggered a huge diplomatic spat earlier this year. Then you have the Turks, who are not pleased at all with the Americans for a whole host of reasons, including their backing of the SDF. So there's not a great amount of trust on either side. Trump has imposed a few light sanctions on the Turks for various reasons, including their dealings. And they've obviously been feeling the effects of U.S. sanctions on Venezuela and Iran, because Turkey does business with both countries. But this is, again, Trump's main leverage in almost any political dispute around the world has been a threat of sanctions. It's his favorite tool. But it is rather strange to, in one hand, offer a huge strategic gift to Ankara by saying you're not going to impede this Turkish invasion, and then, on the other hand, offer an incredibly polarizing and potentially insulting threat of economic warfare.
So you're listening to The Brian Lehrer Show on WNYC. I'm Bridget Bergen, sitting in for Brian Lehrer. If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post, about this breaking news as Turkey begins a military offensive in northern Syria. Let's take another caller, Aviva in Manhattan. Welcome to WNYC. What's your comment today?
Thank you, and thank you, as always, for a brilliant session. I'm worried that this is the thread that could pull apart world peace and lead to World War III, because the relationship between Turkey and ISIS and Iraq and the Kurds really is the gateway that has until now been somewhat closed to Europe. And if this opens up, as these actions will open it up, we're on the brink, I think, of World War III. Of all of Trump's actions he's ever taken, this is by far the most terrifying to me.
Aviva, thank you for your comments. And Ishor, that anxiety that she's talking about, is that something that you hear from other Pentagon officials? Is there a sense that what's happening on the ground now could escalate in ways that, you know, could pose a larger threat to the United States foreign policy?
There certainly is anxiety. I would not share the same fear of a kind of global crisis emanating from this. But of course, this is a region that's already experienced a hell of a lot of misery and suffering, that's in still the grips of a pretty brutal civil war and conflict. Iraq, on the other side of the border, is hardly stable itself. It's being gripped by lots of protests and all sorts of political instability. We do see many fears of a resurgence of the Islamic State. Just yesterday, you saw cells in the city of Raqqa, Islamic State cells, attack Syrian Kurdish positions there with suicide bombers and an ambush. And so clearly the jihadists have not been defeated, as President Trump has declared multiple times. Clearly, the current chaos of the moment creates a potential security vacuum where they may resume activities in parts of Syria. The spillover effect is unclear. The Turks have, in agreements with the Europeans, really shut off their borders and closed down on all sorts of refugees being able to make the passage to Europe over the Mediterranean. And so that sort of fear of a spillover into Europe, I don't think is a particularly necessary one at this point. But certainly within the region, there's all sorts of fears. You could see a refugee influx of Syrian Kurds going into Iraq, which is hardly the thing Iraqis want to see at this point, given all the things on their plate. You could see, of course, a whole host of Islamic State detainees escape. And then from the perspective of Washington strategists, you see a scenario where the geopolitical interests of the Russians and the Iranians sort of win out over those of the Americans, because anything that happens now is going to push the SDF and the Syrian Kurds into the arms of the Assad regime and further strengthen its hold over the country in ways that the Americans at this point may not want.
Let's go to Larry in Queens. Larry, what's your comment?
My comment is that I'd like to put in a plug for good old 1930s isolationism. I don't think many Americans really care about the Kurds. I don't think they know anything or care anything about the Kurdistan idea. And I would just say, in addition, we've been conned into all kinds of nonsense, 60,000 in Vietnam, 30,000 in Korea, and whatever we're wasting. And just one final point. Bin Laden said, why do you have troops in Saudi Arabia? No one answers that question. Why do we care about Saudi Arabia having troops in there? And he gave that as his reason for 9/11. So let's have some people that are talking about getting out of all of these places unless we're directly threatened, and not listening to people like, some of the heroes like Rush Limbaugh, Donald Trump, Pat Buchanan, and I could name all George Will, you Rudy Giuliani, all people who avoided going into the service, who are quick to talk about our vested military interests in these places.
Larry, thanks so much for calling. Ishan, that's another point of view. Any response to Larry's comments?
Sure. You know, I think Larry really sums up the ideological crisis now brewing inside the Republican Party. You have a Republican base that increasingly is of that persuasion. I don't know if it's necessarily isolationism, but it's a certain kind of fatigue with American nation building and military interventions elsewhere in the world, while you have a Republican policy establishment in Washington that is entirely of a different mind. And you saw, you have people like Lindsey Graham, who's carrying water for Trump on so many issues, turn around on Monday and very emphatically disagree with him about what's happening. And so this is definitely an ongoing debate within the Republican Party. And it's also obviously a debate that's shaping American foreign policy conversations overall. I think Larry's position is something that many on the left would also be sympathetic to. There is an impatience with an American legacy of blunders overseas, and really ruinous blunders, particularly in Iraq, that have cost thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of lives. And certainly that is something that is factored into Trump's decision-making right now. But I think the situation in Syria is a little bit different. You have a very, ostensibly, a rather tiny American footprint. It's only 1,000 troops. We're talking about the Trump administration right now perhaps having relocated at most 50 soldiers. So it's not exactly about boots on the ground as much as American commitments and American decisions to not fulfill those commitments. The U.S. has really armed and trained the SDF in many ways and really bolstered them. The U.S. has enabled the SDF to hold the fiefdom that they have, and then is deciding to pull the plug on them rather arbitrarily and with no warning. And that is where the criticism comes in. It's not necessarily that Trump is trying to leave this region or disentangle the U.S. from this region. It's that he's done it in a way that has made it unsafe for others and with very little coordination and through impulse and fiat as opposed to genuine strategic deliberation. And that is where that's what's outraged people, both Democrats and Republicans here.
So Doug Goodman from Twitter writes, watching the U.S. relationship with the Kurds since the first Gulf War has been very embarrassing. They're an ally who seemed to have come through again and again, but we have not supported them when they were punished for this, whether it was gassing by Saddam Hussein or today. So Ishan, you write that betraying the Kurds at this point is an American tradition that goes back to the 1970s. Do you want to take us back to the Nixon administration and tell us about what happened then?
Sure. And you know, the people who would say the betraying the Kurds goes back to the end of World War I, where Woodrow Wilson didn't really give the Kurds their own state, while he was giving all sorts of other European ethnic groups their own state. So in the 1970s, the U.S., of course, had a very close relationship with the Iranians, the Shah of Iran. As a favor to the Iranians at the time, who were adversaries of Saddam Hussein in Iraq, the U.S. helped foment a Kurdish uprising in the early 1970s that raged for a number of years. And then all of a sudden, when the Iranians and the Iraqis mended fences at a peace agreement in Algeria, the U.S. just suddenly pulled the plug. The Kurds were left twisting in the wind. Thousands were killed. Many were forced into exile. Some who tried to flee into Iran were pushed back into Iraq for imprisonment and also execution. So it was a great tragedy for the Kurds. Then Kissinger at the time, the Secretary of State Henry Kissinger, kind of quipped that, you know, we're not doing missionary work here. It's just part of realpolitik, and the Kurds have to live with that. And then, of course, in the 1990s, the U.S., after the sort of fight, after liberating Kuwait from the forces of Saddam Hussein, the U.S. urged the Iraqis to rise up. The Kurds in Iraq rose up, as well as Shia in Iraq rose up. And the U.S. did little to defend them, and actually stood by as Saddam Hussein's military really brutally crushed the Kurds and the Shia uprisings, including, as the reader wrote in, the gassing of the Kurds then. So this is a narrative of betrayal and disappointment that everybody knows in Washington. Everyone's well aware of this. There's a lot of ruefulness about this. You have a lot of people in the Pentagon, State Department, Washington foreign policy establishment who are very in their hearts and even in their policy statements very pro-Kurdish aspirations and do feel a sense of genuine commitment to the Kurds for what they've done on behalf of U.S. policy interests over the last few decades. At the same time, there is, in terms of official American policy, nobody's going to argue against the territorial sovereignty of Iraq, territorial sovereignty of Turkey, the territorial sovereignty even of Syria. So no one's going to be calling here for an independent Kurdish state. So the Kurds find themselves in a pretty thankless situation where they're doing a lot of the dirty work, but no one's really ever going to follow through on their national aspirations.
So let's go to David in Elizabeth, New Jersey. Thanks for calling WNYC. What's your comment?
Well, the gentleman there who's more educated and more refined than I am said exactly what I reiterated. I was in the Navy from 91 to 99 and doing stuff, and that's all I can tell you. But I know we knew the whole area of operation, and I'm a retired history teacher with New York City. Once again, yes, like the gentleman just better said, we abandoned an ally. The Kurds kept the oil rigs going during the Syrian thing. Europe owes a lot to them, and it's just, his point was brilliant. I can't add to that. Again, we abandoned a strong ally that's going to resonate for generations. And we abandoned him at the end of the first Gulf War. We gave Saddam back his helicopters, and like the gentleman said, they nerve gassed him. So I'm done. Thanks. Great show.
David, thanks for calling. Let's go to Farhad in Fort Lee, New Jersey.
Hi, this is Farhat. So I think one of the things that I want to cover is in Turkey, we have almost 15% Kurdish population, and Turks and Kurds actually live in peace over the decades. And we have Kurdish presidents, Kurdish senators, Kurdish mayors. So Kurdish is not really far to Turkish culture and Turkish people. So I don't think Turkish people have any problem with the Kurdish. I think the problem is the PKK and the YPG has been fighting with the Turkish military and killing the personnel since 1980s. And over like 50,000 military personnel and their families and the people living in the cities actually killed by the bombings from PKK and YPG. And this never covered in the media. So, and it's covered in Turkish media, but it's not covered in the U.S. or the European media. So now Turkey is actually hosting almost 5 million Syrian refugees. Since 2005, 2006. And now the plan is to open up that safe zone area, which is 20 miles inside the Syrian border, and then put these refugees back to their homes. That's only the plan. And the YPG is basically a terrorist group that is supporting PKK. Yes, they are helping U.S., but actually they're hurting U.S.'s biggest ally, which is Turkey. So that's all I want to say.
Farhad, thanks for calling WNYC. Ishan, we had two different perspectives there. One from a veteran and someone with ties to the region. Any response to either of them?
Yes, well, I think the both those comments point to the complexity of the situation and the different ways in which various actors and regional powers interpret and view these Kurdish factions. And you know, the Turkish view, of course, is that the YPG, SDF are not different from the PKK. The American view is that let's try to ignore that and let's focus on how much good they've done on our behalf. It's not true that the Western media hasn't covered PKK attacks. I myself have written numerous pieces on PKK-linked terror attacks in Turkey. But at the same time, as the caller said, absolutely, plenty of Kurds. There's a huge Kurdish population in Turkey. They don't all agree with the same set of views. They have the many differences, and there are many who oppose the PKK. But there are also many who are not not enamored with the Turkish state. I've been to Kurdish areas in Turkey where I've been to graveyards where you have Turkish citizens who volunteered with the YPG fighting the Islamic State, and they have massive graveyards in the city of Diyarbakir where all these people have gone across the border and died. And these are people who really believe in the cause of the YPG, and they are in Turkey as well. And so this is something that concerns the Turkish state, because obviously they don't like the popular appeal of groups like the YPG and the PKK. And this is something that, you know, we have to see as well. You need to have a political resolution in Syria, but you also need to reopen dialogue between Turkey and the PKK as well on the other side of the border. Until you do that, you're not going to have a meaningful, peaceful resolution to the whole conflagration that we're seeing right now in the region.
Ishan, this whole situation feels so dynamic and it feels like it is changing by the moment. Can you tell us what are you going to be watching for today and in the next few days?
Well, absolutely. We have to see how far the Turks go in their incursions. We have to see the kind of violence that takes place as well. We have to see what happens to civilians who are potentially caught in this incursion, and whether the militias that the Turks are sending in, these are Syrian militias that have some Islamist elements, whether they do anything particularly extreme to the civilians there. There are a lot of fears of potential ethnic cleansing in these areas. Both sides accuse the others of either depopulating it from Arabs or depopulating Kurds. So it's a pretty tense situation there. And then, of course, we do obviously have to watch these camps where the Islamic State detainees are being kept. What's going to happen there? The Kurds, the Syrian Kurds, the SDF recognizes that perhaps the only leverage they have on the world stage right now is potentially, you know, their ability to let these guys go free. They don't necessarily want to let them go free, but this is the one way they can get attention and sympathy for their plight. We'll see if they use that. And we'll see also, you know, how the U.S. decides to to check or push back against any Turkish excesses in this incursion. But there's a lot at stake. As you said, it's incredibly fluid. And there are many differing opinions, even within this administration. The Pentagon, folks you talk to in the Pentagon, folks you talk to at State, are really unhappy with the way this has played out. And the White House is hell-bent on beginning a process where the U.S. can extract itself. And they feel this is a key part of that process.
We have to leave it there. Thank you to Ishan Tharoor, foreign affairs writer for The Washington Post. This is The Brian Lehrer Show. I'm Bridget Bergen, City Hall and politics reporter for the WNYC Newsroom, filling in for Brian. More to come.